Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 309, titled The Ties That Bind. This is being recorded on July 1st of the year 2001. We've been taking a look at not only operations of fascism around the world, but also over the years, and one of the countries that receives very little discussion, well, a country that receives very little discussion, and it's a very, very small country indeed, in fact, wields an outsized role in world affairs, and this is due largely to the economic power that this particular country wields in Europe and around the world. That country is Luxembourg, and as we've looked at in past broadcasts, Luxembourg was one of the epicenters of not only Third Reich financial manipulations, but indeed Luxembourg, a tiny country, was a major focal point for some of the Third Reich operations that overlapped and grew into the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, about which I've spoken so many times. We're going to take a look at two enterprises that are based in Luxembourg. One of them is the RTL television company that we looked at in connection with the vitally important ongoing series about German and Bormann corporate control over the American media. And the other is a steel-making firm called Arbed, A-R-B-E-D, which, as we will see, was begun during the Second World War by the Third Reich. And that's one of those connections that not only has extended down through the years, but has some very interesting connections to names perhaps better known than Arbed. And we're going to take a look at some of those. The following article is from the Financial Times of Friday, June 8th of the year 2001. This is an article by Daniel Dombey, or Dombey, D-O-M-B-E-Y. It's headlined, Tiny Landlocked State Casts a Global Influence, subtitled A New Monarch and a Year of Success for its Blue Chip Companies has given the EU's smallest state much to cheer about. And we're going to take a look at two of the companies that this tiny EU state is cheering about. One of them, again, the aforementioned Arbed Steel firm, and the other one, the RTL television company. Skipping down in this story, we read, Arbed, the steel group that was the mainstay of the country's economy until the explosion of the Luxembourg banking sector, also plans to become the biggest in the world through its merger with Usinor of France and Aceralia of Spain. Usinor is U-S-I-N-O-R and Aceralia, A-C-R-A-L-I-A. So please note that Arbed, the Luxembourg-based steel company, is on track to become the largest steel-making company in the world and is merged with two European companies, one in France and one in Spain. We're going to come back to Arbed and the role of Luxembourg, not only in Third Reich finances, but also in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization in just a minute. In conjunction with the discussion of German corporate control and Bormann control of the American media, we've discussed RTL, that's Europe's largest television station, and it is poised to move into the American telecommunications market, that market now being deregulated by Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, who's head of the FCC, and it is being opened up still further to foreign access. Of RTL and Bertelsmann and Albert Frère, the financier, the Belgian financier who runs RTL, we read, RTL, the group formed last year by the fusion of assets held by Bertelsmann, the Belgian financier Albert Frère, and Pearson, the owner of the Financial Times, has already become Europe's largest broadcaster with a television audience of over $100 million. Such developments have a certain resonance. The banking groups that arrived in the 1960s and multiplied in subsequent decades were always overwhelmingly international in composition. But industrial groups were different. Modern Luxembourg was built on the steel business, more about that in a minute I would add parenthetically, and the country's broadcasters won a special place in Luxembourg society through their use of the Letzburgisch, the national language. In the past, companies such as Arbed and RTL have reinforced people's sometimes tenuous sense of national identity. First of all, we're going to examine Arbed, that's the Luxembourg-based steel company, as we will see, Luxembourg in name only, but actually controlled by the economy of the Third Reich, and in the post-war period by the Bormann Organization. Arbed was actually formed during the Second World War under German auspices. And for a discussion of the Borman Flight Capital Organization, we're going to turn to the definitive work on the subject, a book that I've accessed many times in the past. That book is called Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, authored by Paul Manning, part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe under Edward R. Murrow. He covered air raids into New York. Not yet, anyway. Air raids into Europe by training as a gunner to fly aboard B-17s, and then broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network. He then trained as a gunner aboard a B-29 to cover the air raids into Japan, and then broadcast the surrender of Japan on the CBS radio network as well, and was basically crucified in a professional sense through his post-World War II investigation, or as a result, in retribution for his post-World War II investigations of the Borman Organization. Ultimately, his son Jerry Manning was murdered in order to dissuade Paul Manning from publishing a follow-up book to Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile. Now, in Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, there's discussion not only of the German control of the Luxembourg economy during World War II, but the central role of the steel business and Arbed in the Luxembourg-based steel business. And we're also going to take a look at how, in the post-war period, these pro-German connections, these German Luxembourgeois or Luxemburger, I don't know what the adjective would be, industrial connections continued into the post-war period, where Luxembourg remained an epicenter of the Bormann Group. Of the formation of Arbed under German occupation, we read as follows in Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile. And bear in mind that Arbed is now poised to become the largest steelmaking company in the world. Paul Manning writes, "A similar pattern was developed for Luxembourg, a country smaller than Rhode Island, whose principal industry is iron and steel. The Germans annexed Luxembourg, as they did Alsace-Lorraine, and it became an administered territory like Poland, Belgium, and Holland, where local nationals did not serve as government. Gustav Koenigs, K-O-E-N-I-G-S, chairman of Hamburg America Shipping Line and a director of many companies, was appointed Reich trustee of Arbed, an important Luxembourg steel cartel by the German Ministry of Economics. There were in Arbed 250,000 shares outstanding, the majority held by Luxembourgers, Belgians, and French in that order. German shareholders, largely through their banks, accounted for 54,747 shares. Some were held by British and Americans through their secret accounts in Swiss banks. A shift in control was made when Gustav Koenigs, as Reich trustee, also became trustee of the Belgian and French-held shares. On April 19, 1943, a shareholders' meeting was held in Luxembourg City, and the capital of the company was converted from francs into Reichsmarks. Arbed was recapitalized at 300 million Reichsmarks, or $120 million, and under German direction, the cartel became the third largest iron and steel company in Europe, ranking behind only Germany's Vereinigte Stahlwerke and the Gehring Steelworks. Of course, Vereinigte Stahlwerke later became Thyssen AG. By the way, I've been mispronouncing that. Fritz Thyssen, the key industrial ally of the Busch family, and we're going to touch back on the Busch family. It's spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. I've been pronouncing it Thyssen. I understand it's actually pronounced Thyssen, as though the Y were a U. But Vereinigte Stahlwerke later became Thyssen AG. Continuing. A sales company was then formed under the name of Luxembourg Iron and Steel Company to market all Arbed products throughout Europe. It was capitalized at 1.5 million Reichsmarks. To further tighten German control over the iron and steel output of this small mountainous country, all of the iron mines in Luxembourg were combined and amalgamated into one unified association under German direction. This association was named Lützelurg, and its advisory board was appointed by the chief of the German civil administration. Gustav Koenigs, as Reich trustee of Arbed, served as president of Lützelurg. That's spelled capital L-U-E-T-Z-E-L-L-U-R-G. So note that the head of Arbed, the Reich's trustee, was Gustav Koenigs, and that he was chairman of the Hamburg America shipping line. More about that in just a couple of minutes. Of the post-World War II perpetuation of German economic control of Luxembourg, we read as follows in Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile. Elbert D. Thomas of Utah, when he was chairman of the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Military Affairs, commented in Washington on June 26, 1945, "We had a mission in Luxembourg which was obtaining quite a bit of information on the steel cartel until the Grand Duchess returned. Information was then blocked off from us, and the mission had to retire with what information they had already collected. There was much to learn about the way in which small states like Luxembourg have been used by the cartels. The episode suggests that some rulers whom we have befriended may be expected to assist the cartelists in their post-war efforts to regain dominance." When Grand Duchess Charlotte learned from her finance minister on her return to Luxembourg was simple, quote, "Don't tamper with the money machine. We made record profits during the German era, and there is every indication we will be going into an even greater period of prosperity once Germany recovers. They will then continue to be our biggest customer. All that is required now is a readjustment in stock ownership to please Belgian, French, British, and American shareholders, which will be done," unquote. Open German stock ownership was reduced to its former position of about 20% in Luxembourg industry, and the German trustee was eliminated. But at board meetings, Belgian and French banks voted as blocks on behalf of shareholders, of stockholders, in Germany. By the way, in numerous broadcasts, we've taken a look at the post-World War II German and Bormann control of French finance and industry. Continuing, "The German voice in the wings was still there, and as time went on in Luxembourg, increasingly the voice could be heard loud and clear, the customer speaking to the seller, the equalizer of the marketplace. Grand Duchess Charlotte, who was to retire during the 60s to be succeeded by her son, Grand Duke Jean, always believed that the new prosperity of Luxembourg after the war was testimony to her decision in 1945 not to permit interference with the German financial and industrial apparatus. The German banks, Deutsche and Dresdner, remained in position, and the Luxembourg financial community continued to look to Frankfurt rather than to Zurich, London, and New York for financial guidance." ARBED, its sales organization in New York City, is Amerlux Products, continues as a powerful and prosperous steel cartel closely tied to its German mentors. And again, that's the company that is now, I guess one could say, along with RTL, the pride of Luxembourg. In numerous broadcasts, we've taken a look at the Hamburg-America line. Now, note that Gustav Koenigs was chairman of the Hamburg-America shipping line. In numerous broadcasts, we've detailed the role of the, or touched on the role of the Hamburg-America shipping line in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. At the meeting on August 10, 1944, in Strasbourg, in Alsace-Lorraine, SS General Dr. Scheid was setting forth the companies that had been very useful to the Third Reich, and one of those companies that was described as being especially effective in protecting German interests abroad was the Hamburg-America line. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, speaking of Scheid, he also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg-America line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men present. And one has to wonder whether perhaps one of the addresses that he was given was that of 39 Broadway, because 39 Broadway was the company that, there was the address, I should say, that the Hamburg-America Line's American branch shared with the Union Banking Corporation. Both companies were controlled by the Walker and Bush families. George Herbert Walker was George W.'s great-grandfather and one of Hitler's three earliest and most prominent financial backers. George W.'s grandfather, Prescott Bush Sr., was a key executive with many of these companies, including Union Banking and also Hamburg-America Line. And Hamburg-America Line was, in addition to being a Third Reich company, was a key Third Reich espionage vehicle and propaganda vehicle in North America. And again, this is one of the companies whose American subsidiary was controlled by the ancestors of George W. Bush. Speaking of the, well, we're going to detail briefly, and I've discussed this in numerous programs, we're going to detail briefly the connection between the Walker and Bush families and Hamburg-America line. We're going to turn to the book The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. This is an excellent book, and it's been recently remaindered. It has not had the impact that I believe it's due, due largely, I suspect, to the title, The Secret War Against the Jews, which has, I suspect, limited its interest, because a lot of people, well, they say, well, I don't want to read about Jews, or it sounds like some sort of grandiose conspiracy theory. In fact, there has never been an individual volume with more of the information that I talk about on this program between its covers, and very few with as much. One of the recent happy exceptions being Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International by Kevin Coogan. There aren't many titles about which that could be said. Of the connection between the Walker-Bush families and the Hamburg-America line, and the Hamburg-America line's efforts on behalf of the Third Reich, the authors Loftus and Ahrens write as follows. Speaking of George Herbert Walker, Walker also set up a deal to take over the North American operations of the Hamburg-America line, a cover for I.G. Farben's Nazi espionage unit in the United States. The shipping line smuggled in German agents' propaganda and money for bribing American politicians to see things Hitler's way. The holding company was Walker's American Shipping and Commerce, which shared the offices at 39 Broadway with Union Banking. In an elaborate corporate paper trail, Harriman's stock in American Shipping and Commerce was controlled by yet another holding company, the Harriman 15 Corporation, run out of Walker's office. The directors of this company were Averell Harriman, Burt Walker, and Prescott Bush, Sr. Skipping down, a 1934 congressional investigation alleged that Walker's, quote, Hamburg-America line subsidized a wide range of pro-Nazi propaganda efforts both in Germany and the United States. And we're going to take a look, ultimately, at we're going to take a look at one of the key corporate allies enlisted by the Bush family to help mask these assets. And I've noted in, among other programs, For the Record broadcast number 273, that the post-war Bush fortune, the post-war Bush family fortune, was derived in considerable measure from the post-World War II liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation, which was a Tucson-Bush family operation. And the post-war liquidation of Union Banking Corporation would inevitably have involved the Bormann Organization. And as we've looked at in numerous past discussions of the Bush family connections to the Third Reich, the lawyer that was hired by the Bush family in order to basically mask these corporate assets was someone who was very much practiced at doing that, and an individual who later played a key role in helping to boost the career of the elder George Bush. That man was Alan Dulles, a key World War II intelligence operative, and someone who basically was one of the top corporate operatives for the Axis nations in the United States. Alan Dulles is an individual we've spoken about at great length in many broadcasts. Speaking of Dulles' efforts to mask the Bush family Nazi money, instead of divesting the Nazi money, Bush hired a lawyer to hide the assets. The lawyer he hired had considerable expertise in such underhanded schemes. It was Alan Dulles. According to Dulles' client list at Sullivan and Cromwell, his first relationship with Brown Brothers Harriman was on June 18, 1936. In January of 1937, Dulles listed his work for the firm as, quote, disposal of Standard Oil investing stock, unquote. And one of the things that John Loftus and Mark Ahrens write about, and we've talked about the Bush family connections to the Third Reich in the past, and also spoken at great length about the prominent role of American corporations in the Third Reich, one of the things that has not been reported to the extent that it might have been. Well, indeed, the Bush family connections to the Third Reich have not been reported to the extent that they might have been, but there was actually a move afoot by both Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of course, then President of the United States, and his Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, to use the Operation Safe Haven intercepts to prosecute those who had operated in the United States on behalf of Nazi Germany. Now, Operation Safe Haven was the U.S. Treasury Department operation that was conducted in order to interdict the Bormann Flight Capital Program, and ultimately when the war ended and when the residua of the Third Reich went underground and allied themselves with, among other elements, the U.S. government, that operation was interdicted. Operation Safe Haven, had it been successfully pursued and had the information from the Operation Safe Haven wiretap intercepts been properly pursued, would have resulted in the prosecution of, among others, Alan Dulles and the Bush family for assisting the Third Reich. And this was one of the things that FDR was pursuing. Had Franklin Delano Roosevelt lived, then many of the prominent American industrialists and financiers who had assisted the Nazis, including Prescott Bush Sr. and George Herbert Walker, George W.'s grandfather and great-grandfather respectively, would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg instead of in Who's Who in America, which is where they wound up. In the Secret War Against the Jews, Loftus and Ahrens discuss the intent of Franklin Roosevelt and his Treasury Secretary to pursue charges against those American and British industrialists and financiers who had helped to finance the Third Reich. We read about this. The one issue upon which Roosevelt was unyielding was his insistence that after the war, the German bankers must stand in the dock at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. This is confirmed by the top-secret White House Justice Department correspondence files. The plan was to wait until Hermann Abs, Krupp, Flieck, and the rest of the industrialists were charged. Then, Henry Morgenthau, that was Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau, I would add, would unleash the wiretap evidence showing that the Nazis had hidden their stolen assets in Switzerland with the help of Alan Dulles. The whole scandal of Western aid to the German economy would unravel. All the slights of the Standard Oil blackmail would be avenged. The sudden release of the Safe Haven intercepts would force a public outcry to bring treason charges against those British and American businessmen who aided the enemy in time of war. The targets included not only the Dulles brothers, but Forrestal and major industrialists such as Henry Ford. By the way, I would add that, of course, would have included Bush's progenitors as well. Continuing. From a prosecutor's point of view, indicting the German bankers first was a brilliant strategy. To save themselves, Hermann Abs and Hjalmar Schacht would have to reveal the whole history of their sordid dealings with companies such as Ford Motor. Despite the shields of Swiss banking laws and the layers of corporations that Dulles had erected, he had never anticipated that the Swiss bank codes and cables would ever become public knowledge. Roosevelt and Morgenthau would have hanged him and all his colleagues for ever breaking the power of the pirates of international finance. It was a glorious dream, yet the scheme completely fell apart because someone had tipped off Dulles that he was under surveillance. Note again, as Loftus and Ahrens write here, Roosevelt and Morgenthau, speaking of Alan Dulles, Roosevelt and Morgenthau would have hanged him and all his colleagues for ever breaking the power of the pirates of international finance. Well, of course, they didn't get around to doing that. One of the pirates of international finance, a couple of pirates of international finance that might have been hanged, were a couple of Dulles' clients, namely Prescott Bush Sr. and George Herbert Walker, whose last name George W. carries as a middle name. And the Operation Safe Haven intercepts were basically those are the wiretap evidence that Loftus and Ahrens are referring to in that passage. Again, Operation Safe Haven was the code name for the Treasury Department and U.S. intelligence operation to interdict the attempt by the Third Reich to safely sequester their assets in neutral countries during and after World War II. The Safe Haven files were accessed at great length by Paul Manning in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and they comprise a significant element of the documentation for that book. There may be listeners who are wondering again why I'm spending the amount of time on the Borman organization that I have spent on it. It was accurately described by one banker, quoted in some correspondence of Paul Manning's, as, quote, the greatest concentration of money power under a single control in all of world history. As noted in For the Record program number 99, Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, the Borman organization was the culmination of the five most significant tides of capital flow, arguably anyway, in this last century. And I would note that in The Splendid Blonde Beast, as noted in For the Record program number 99, British intelligence estimated the amount of money looted from occupied Europe minus what was looted from the former Soviet Union and Greece at $143 billion, and that would be in early 1940s dollars. I don't know how that would extend out to contemporary dollars, but it certainly would be many trillions of dollars, probably equal to, maybe even greater than the U.S. national debt. And that has been supplemented by several tides of capital flow in the post-war years, and that capital has been invested and multiplied many, many times over. The Borman organization is, quite literally, again, the most important concentration of money power under a single control in all of world history. And had the Operation Safe Haven intercepts been pursued and the perpetrators subjected to justice, then Alan Dulles, Prescott Bush, George Herbert Walker, and others would not be in the would not occupy the lofty position in American history and in American society that they have. I think it's a pretty safe bet that George W. would not be president of the United States. A long-blocked project to create a World War II memorial has finally gotten underway, but not without some irony. And that irony concerns the identity of some of the people who are going to be helping to make this particular monument. That was discussed in, among other newspapers, the Los Angeles Times of Friday, June 15th of the year 2001. This is an article by Jonathan Peterson of the L.A. Times, at Stateline, Washington, and headlined, Memorial Builder's Owner Had Nazi Ties. Subtitled, German Parent of Contractor Used Slaves to Aid Fight Against Nazis. It reads at Stateline, Washington, and it reads in part as follows. They were enemies during World War II. The American soldiers struggling to defeat a fierce German military, and Germany's Philipp Holtzmann Construction Company, which was racing to complete a Nazi aircraft factory with the aid of slave labor. Now, in the latest flap over a World War II monument planned for the National Mall, U.S. officials have awarded a construction contract to Holtzmann's American subsidiary, sparking a barrage of criticism. Quote, when I found out about it, I said, this is the United States. This is impossible, unquote, recalled Jack Bronze, a retired physician in Covina who was among the forced laborers at Holtzmann. Quote, is this the company to put up a memorial to honor war veterans? It's immoral, unquote. Well, won't get any argument from me on that score. But again, these are some of the ties that bind, and there's a brutal unintended irony in the awarding of the contract to build the World War II Memorial in Washington to the American subsidiary of a Nazi company. I've alluded to other broadcasts during the course of the discussion. Those broadcasts are available on tape or CD from a service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The For the Record programs have been footnoted for about the last year or so, since the beginning of July of the year 2000, and the For the Record programs are now being archived on Real Audio by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. There are a number of For the Record programs that are streaming on WFMU's website, wfmu.org/Dave Emory, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, and there are Real Audio files that are available for downloading on a different URL, http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/capital D, capital X, /. And there are links to both of the WFMU websites on the Spitfire website as well. Listeners can email me at demory@kfjc.org, and they can listen to the three-hour program that I do from 7 to 10 p.m. Sunday night Pacific time on KFJC-FM in the South San Francisco Bay Area at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. This concludes For the Record Program number 309, The Ties That Bind. This is being recorded on July 1st of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.